Checkerfin.
Fordham is always in my head.
Checkerfin. Checkerfin.
Yes.
It's the education gadfly
sex,
show.
Sex.
Mike and Rick tell you
early college, high school, pain and suffering,
in your face, in your face, in your face.
Listen to your word that they be preaching, cause here's the education gadfly show. Yeah.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my guest co-host, a woman that Rick Hess says is easy on the eyes, the wonderful Kate Walsh.
Hello, Michael. How are you?
I'm well, Kate. How are you?
I'm great.
You want to respond to Rick's characterization?
No, I was told I should be offended by it, but I have to say I wasn't.
I think Rick meant nothing. Nothing
untoward. Just as long as he doesn't insult my intelligence.
Exactly. Now, speaking of what people like to call you, I understand that there's a blogger out there that's calling you Major Walsh. I mean, what's that about? Why is she calling you Major Walsh?
I thought we weren't
going
to talk about that, Mike.
Oh, come on, Kate. This is good stuff.
I say what's on my mind, and I say it in a rather emphatic way. And apparently, according to the blogger, I call people nincompoops, so I'm not aware that I've used that expression lately.
I could imagine it, though, Kate.
Unfortunately, I could, too.
You know, the last time that you were on, we talked about your comparability article, which just continues to really get a lot of attention and make many people very angry.
Yeah, it's been interesting because I've been told I'm flat out wrong, and the federal policy can't be fashioned after the stupid things that districts do. And I respectfully disagree.
Right. So we should instead just be naive about what might happen out there. And if bad things happen, just blame it on the district.
Well, we can go ahead and disrupt staffing in schools for 5 or 10 years. It'll all work out in the end. And there's nothing to be lost by that.
Yeah. No. I mean, this is it's one thing to call bad policy implementation, unintended consequences. But if we can anticipate those unintended consequences, then they almost seem like they're intended.
You've said it very well. I think it's incumbent upon us to, if we know something is a likely outcome, that the law has to deal with that. And certainly the law is not going to deal with it by saying you can't transfer teachers out of schools. I mean, that's districts will still transfer teachers out of schools, whether or not the law says they shouldn't.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess the debate will go on, but we do have a busy show today. We have an interview with Chris Cerf, who works for New York City Schools. Chancellor Joel Klein is going to respond to some things that we said on the podcast a few weeks ago. And, of course, we have Education News of the Weird with Liam. But first, we're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. Does that sound good?
Sounds great.
All right, Christina, get us started.
All right. Charles Glenn, the dean of the Boston University School of Education, had a piece in the Boston Globe this week. He explained that, quote, "Controversy flared recently when the Massachusetts Department of Education asked its Educational Personnel Advisory Council to review why many minority teacher candidates failed the state's licensure exams," tough word, "on the communication and literacy skills test administered during the 2005-2006 school year, 77% of white teacher candidates passed the communication section, compared with just 48% of Hispanic and 46% of African American test takers. On the literacy section, 86% of white test takers passed, compared with 62% of African American and 61% of Hispanic candidates," unquote. Kate, does this mean that these tests are discriminatory? Is getting rid of these tests a good idea?
Well, first of all, let me thank you so much for bringing up an issue of race for me to discuss today. That's very kind of you.
These are always the easiest issues to deal with here on the podcast, Kate.
But, I do feel strongly about this. And you want to write about this with some sensitivity. But you're always worried that even the most sensitive crafting of your words will be misinterpreted. Certainly, the Massachusetts test is no more discriminatory than any other test out there. On every test that's administered that I'm aware of, from the SAT to GREs to any sort of test, the level of performance is lower overall for African Americans over whites. And there are a lot of reasons for that. And, we could talk about that for about 20, 25 minutes instead of 10, but...
Okay, but you still think that it's reasonable to require teachers to have to pass these tests in order to be given entry into the profession?
I don't think we have any choice. I mean, I think certainly one can argue that American testing to get into the teaching profession is so much lower than what other countries require. And if we are going to raise our own student level performance, there's no choice but to establish these standards of rigor that have to be held firm by states, as difficult as it is. I've been in a lot of school board meetings where ed schools come in and then they're all upset. They're saying you're shutting out minority candidates, and boards face tremendous pressure to lower cut scores for these tests. But who is it that suffers? It's the children back in the classroom. More minorities are going to serve in schools which teach a high number of minority children. And so it's those children who are going to get the teachers who didn't pass the test.
Well said, Kate. I do have one more question very quickly, if I can ask your permission, Kobe, to go a little over on the time here. Which is this, there's been some research that shows, though, right, that that minority students do somewhat better if they are taught by a teacher of their same race.
Well, yes, that's true to the extent that if all things are equal, a child will do better when the race is matched. But, you know, I've talked to Ron Ferguson, a researcher up at Harvard, who is himself African-American, and he says he feels very strongly that you shouldn't make your primary hiring decision based on race. That, sure, it's great if you can bring more African-American teachers into a building serving African-American children, but you can't make that your primary factor upon which to base hiring.
Okay. Well said. Christina, next question.
New York Times columnist Bob Herbert wrote about Fordham's new report, The Proficiency Illusion, in his column this week. In it, he used our study to argue against high-stakes testing, quoting testing expert Dan Koretz as saying that tests used for accountability purposes are automatically suspect. Is that a fair takeaway from our report, that high-stakes testing can't work?
Kate, did you know that we are out with a new report this month?
Actually, in all seriousness, that's a fabulous report and very, very important, and should be, you know, widely read. And you'll invite me back next week to co-host.
Okay, very nicely said. That's not even in your script. Well, so, but of course, you never know what's going to happen with your work once it's out there. And lo and behold, New York Times columnist Bob Herbert picked up on it in a column when he was really arguing against high-stakes testing. And I think what Dan Koretz was arguing when he was quoted at length in the Herbert column was that once you have high stakes attached to these tests, and you're not just using them as measuring tools anymore, but that you're really using them to try to force some sort of behavioral change, that you see all kinds of game playing, you see various forms of cheating, so to speak, and that there's plenty of studies, ours being the latest, that shows that the big gains that are showing up on these state test results aren't showing up on other measurements, making you wonder if kids are really learning more reading and math or just learning how to take these particular tests. So the question is, you know, how do we face all of this information without just getting rid of testing and accountability? Can it be salvaged?
Well, as long as we insist on having 51 different versions of these things, we're making the matters worse. What you all write about is clearly, you know, not an issue with having high-stakes tests. What you're all writing about is the point that states, one, don't know what they're doing, or if they do know what they're doing, it's even worse. It's, you know, that they're complicit in this act and not contributing to the real goals behind accountability and higher standards. So, you know, to my mind, the report speaks very strongly for the need to have a national test, but perhaps that's not the most popular view.
But it is popular here on the show today, Kate. All right, we've got to disagree about something. Maybe Christina will give us something to disagree about in question number three.
Mike. Yeah.
I hope so. The New York Times had a front page story this week on state lotteries, specifically how so little money from lotteries is finding its way into public school coffers, even though these lottery programs are sold to the public as dollars for scholars. Is this a problem?
Why are we surprised? You know, these lotteries hold huge appeal to politicians who need to balance a budget, and they get them passed, and, you know, it's very seductive. And then they use them for this or that to fill this gap here, this gap there, and all the promises made go out the window. And, you know, it's just so, it's so predictable.
You know, this story kind of drove me crazy because early on in the story, they show some statistics. Statistics. For example, they would say, well, only 1% of a state's education budget is coming from the lottery, which you used to think, oh my God, that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But by putting it that way, what they're not saying is the bigger part of the story, which is that we're spending so much money on K-12 education that even a lottery that might be providing hundreds of millions of dollars to a big state isn't making much of a dent in the overall bill. So I just think that it didn't provide readers with a whole lot of context. There's certainly a question about, you know, look, if the politicians maybe made promises that they're not keeping. But it's hard to argue that education right now is not being well-funded at the state level.
Well, I don't think that was the point of the article. I think it was much more about the shifting, you know, the shifting tides, so to speak, that the public thinks that they're just sending, you know, all this money into K-12 education from the lottery. I don't think anybody would disagree with your premise that there's a lot of money going into K-12 education. But, you know, that when funding, you know, that there are always these changes to what was promised. And I don't think the public's kept apprised of how it changes.
Well, Kate, yes, we did struggle to find anything to disagree about, but that's okay. It was still lovely having you on. Pardon the gadfly. All right. Now we've got our interview with Chris Cerf at the New York City Department of Education. Let's take a listen. Joining us today on the Education Gadfly Show is Chris Cerf, Deputy Chancellor at the New York City Department of Education. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I really appreciate your having me on.
So a few weeks ago, I had the original Education Gadfly, Checker Finn, here on the show. And we were talking a bit about New York City winning the Broad Prize this year. And Chris and I believe your colleagues there in New York City had some concerns about what Checker and I had to say. So we invited Chris on the air here to respond. So, Chris, go ahead. What were some of the major concerns about our comments?
Thank you very much. First of all, we're very proud that the Broad Foundation recognized our work here last month. The Broad Prize has become something of the Nobel Prize for urban school reform. It's actually, if you read the technical mission statement, it is awarded to the urban district, quote, with the greatest overall performance and improvement in student achievement while reducing the achievement gap. And we were all quite taken aback during the podcast when Checker, who I have deep admiration for, by the way, chose to cast certain doubts on the prize by rather sarcastically suggesting that because Broad had generously funded some of our reforms, the objectivity of the award was in some doubt. I think he said, and I think you, Mike, agreed that it was, quote, a little bit like giving a prize to one's own child. And then there was a further suggestion citing Diane Ravitch that there was a concern that there was, quote, more spin than achievement, and so on from there. So I wanted to just, and I appreciate the opportunity to correct what I believe are objectively inaccurate statements of fact. So let me just start with the Broad Prize. Okay. It is anything but subjective in its award. There is a panel of very distinguished folks who look at 100 districts across the country based on publicly available achievement data. These are the folks who nominate the five finalists, and I think to suggest they lack objectivity would be a curious thing to suggest. Then the panel looks at a number of very objective factors. They hire, the Broad Foundation hires, essentially an education accounting firm and a qualitative firm to evaluate it. And then their recommendations are given to another distinguished panelist, which includes two former secretaries of education, the president, Andrew Stern of the SEIU. And as it's been explained to me, they take those recommendations, they vote anonymously, and the Broad Foundation is committed to accepting their vote, quite independent of any biases that they may or may not have. So okay, I just think okay. that the statement about the lack of objectivity just was false. And the other thing that I would mention is what really amounts to a canard that first was issued by Sol Stern to the effect that our press office has some 29 people in it, and he said there's more spin than achievement, and I'd love to attribute that to being an honest mistake. The problem is it's not only off by orders and orders of magnitude, but we had explained all that before he made that suggestion in the City Journal.
So to get the facts straight, sure. So how many people are in the New York City press office?
There are about 13 people who are in the press secretary's office. What happened is that Mr. Stern, no doubt meaning well, misread a budget document and ascribed all sorts of personnel to the press office who, in fact, do not work in the press office.
Okay. And then finally, what was your last point?
The last point has to do with student achievement, and I'd love to send you documents so your readers or listeners can look at this on hard copy or online. But just a couple quick things: we are all about student achievement. That is what we do. That is what our mission is. That's what our commitment is. And to suggest that this is that somehow our achievement is in question is a curious thing to say, and just a couple things I'll throw your way. In math, if you look at the changes since Mayor Bloomberg and the Chancellor got here, we are up 22 percentile points in fourth grade math, which is about four times the rate of increase for the other big four in the state: Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, and Yonkers, and at least three times the state at large. The numbers are even more spectacular when you get to the eighth grade. And what I quickly want to add here, because another canard that has been sort of put out there, is that, oh, well, gee, that's 2002 to 2007. You guys shouldn't get credit for 2003. For the first year. What is interesting, and I again be glad to send you these numbers, is that no matter how you look at it, if you look at it 2003 to 2007, 2002 to 2007, we're really having really notable success in mathematics, and we are also having very great success in English language arts, not quite at the same order of magnitude, but again, and I won't bore you with statistics, but considerably beating the state and the locals and the other urbans across the state.
Okay.
The punchline of all this is that we're very proud of what we do and very grateful that the Broad Foundation recognized our achievements. And we're somewhat taken aback when the gadfly decided to cast aspersions on that.
All right. Well, that's all very fair, Chris. Of course, the gadfly, what we do is we are a gadfly. We do raise questions. We appreciate the feedback and the input. I will note that, of course, Checker said lots of nice things about Chancellor Klein and his reforms as well. But we can remain concerned about some of the curricular things happening in New York City. But we will watch this story unfold. And by all means, congratulations on the Broad Prize.
I appreciate it, and I get the last word on the curricular thing. I think you all have been very consistent on that point, and I admire your persistence on that, but you will need to answer for your listenership if your concerns are about the math curriculum, how do you account for these rather spectacular gains. On that note, I appreciate it very much, and good talking with you.
Okay, thanks so much, Chris. Again, Chris Cerf, Deputy Chancellor at the New York City Department of Education. So, Kate, Chris may think he gets the last word. But he doesn't get the last word. It's our podcast. We get the last word. What do you think? What do you think about what he had to say?
Well, his last word didn't address the reading issue, which is of concern to us as well, what New York does for a reading curriculum. So
that's right.
You know, I mean, he left that out of the
last word. That's been, of course, our major concern is around reading, that basically New York City has rejected scientifically based reading research and has been doing the bare minimum to get the Reading First grants from the federal government. And we have a lot of concerns about that. Okay, Kate, it's that special time, the time we wait for all week long. Education news of the weird time. With our special correspondent, Liam Julian. Liam, what's weird this week?
After a teaching assistant at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst graded a political philosophy class, specifically problems in social thought, on a curve. And after that curve turned Brian Marquise's A- into a C, Marquise filed a 15-count lawsuit in U.S. District Court. He contends that the university violated his civil rights and contractual rights and intentionally inflicted, quote, emotional distress. Last week, District Court Judge Michael A. Ponzer dismissed the suit, but Marquise, a 51-year-old paralegal, who is worried the C might lower his grade point average and make him less attractive to a law school, is considering an appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit. Quote, this is not something I relish, he said. This is an issue where the empirical data was quite clear and convincing to any reasonable mind that my performance was well within a higher range. Unquote. And that's education news of the weird.
All right, Kate, setting aside Liam's very strange reading with the long, long pauses in there.
He's been taking lessons.
He's good, isn't he? I know. He's a little off his game when Rick's away. I don't know. He's not quite.
The chemistry is not there.
All I know is that Chris Cerf had no critiques of Education News of the Weird. Zero.
Which just means, maybe, Liam, that you're still struggling to be relevant. Kate, what do you think about this? Is this what federal courts should be spending their time doing?
Do you really want me to answer this? Aren't we closing this show?
I should say that next week I will probably not be here. You want to know why, Kate?
I have an idea.
Yes.
Proud papa.
That's right. Hopefully by this time next week I will be a proud papa. It's not a guarantee. I understand that these first babies have a tendency to come late. So if my wife is still pregnant a week from now, we'll do the show. But I don't think she'll be feeling very happy about it.
No,
but if not, we might be taking a little short programming break until I return from paternity leave. But until then, who are you, Kate?
Kate Walsh.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.